Blog Talk Radio.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me. So mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me China, then take a look around, just tell me Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to take race and tell me.
Absolutely. James Bostic here, a conservative perspective on the Tuesday. So we're on Patriot Nation, Patriot Nation Radio here at blogtalkradio.com. We have a recorded version of the program that goes out on Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, prime Sunday news and commentary time slot there at Mojo. 50 radio, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, my friends, you should be, because it is some of the very best, in fact, the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. Buckle up, folks. He's back. That's right. Our very good friend, Michael Cutler, is with us tonight. And I think we're going to call the segment. He doesn't know this because I'm springing it on him right now. That way he can't tell me no. We're going to start calling Michael's visits open mic night, because it gives him a chance to open up the big names. And to be honest with you guys, we're getting so many big guns on this program, I'm thinking about having it sponsored by the NRA. And like, again, tonight is no exception. Mike Cutler's with us. But the thing that I was talking with a friend of mine about is this, and simply when you Michael Cutler goes on David Webb on Sirius XM, which he's a frequent there, and he goes on One American News, and he goes on these places and Newsmax and all these different, you know, programs that are clamoring for him. Why? Well, he's probably America's, is, you know, certainly America's foremost expert when it comes to immigration issues and the existential threat that our immigration system as it exists today presents to us. Well, that's some serious business. And if you've listened to our program and you've heard Mike, you know what, you know that. But he's going to go on Dave Webb. He's going to get 8 minutes, 12 minutes tops. If Sean Hannity was lucky enough for Michael to consent to be on that program, again, 8 minutes, 12 and a half minutes. That's it, because they got to go to a commercial. That's not enough time to get the information that is so important out. And these guys, Michael Cutler, no exception, a wellspring of information when it comes to their various avenues of pursuit. And now, as I introduce our friend, I would just like to point out before we get started that nobody is perfect. And I only introduce them. I don't guarantee them. But in this case, I can. Our friend Michael Cutler. Mike, welcome to A Conservative's Perspective. I'm really glad to get to talk to you today.
James, it's always a privilege and pleasure to join you. I appreciate how generous you are with your time. I love doing those other programs, but nobody gives me more time than you do. And we really need the time. You know, the problem that America now has. No, it's serious. I mean, look, as a nation, we have the attention span of goldfish.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to a professor. He was a professor and was a financial guy, also served in the Israeli military, came back to the United States, real good guy. And he said, Mike, do you notice this correlation? When Johnny Carson was the king of late night TV, people would sit there for about 20 minutes without expecting anything, you know, a break or anything, because it was 20 minutes between commercials. Prior to Johnny Carson, people could sit there for 2 hours. People would read entire newspaper articles, if the articles are worth reading in the first place, of course. We're now at the point that the average news program on television, the story runs no more than 3 or 4 minutes. So if you're standing in front of a room filled with people, I've done this many times, after about 4 or 5 minutes, you see some of the people fidgeting in their seats. They're waiting for a commercial. I feel like holding up, I don't know, some some product, right?
Yeah,
and the remarkable thing is most of the products involve drugs or law firms that will sue you for having taken the drug that you probably shouldn't have taken in the first place because it did harm to you. We've become a drug culture, a country where anything that bothers you can be solved with something that you can ingest, which is dangerous. Instead of saying, man up, God forbid, that sounds too much like toxic masculinity. We're told that whatever your problem is, there's a pill for that. Remember when Apple came out with their iPhone, they said there's an app for that? Well, now there's a pill for that. And I just want to start out by talking about this horrific tragedy in Texas. This isn't the first shooting. Tragically, it probably won't be the last. I wish it would. I would do anything for it to be the last. But there's a couple of quick points I want to make. 19 children and 2 teachers were obliterated for no good reason, period. And it wasn't an accident. It was a conscious act by a deviant sociopath. But every day, America loses God knows how many lives to drugs, violence, and the ban goes on because it wasn't so many people at one place that they couldn't ignore it. We lose over 100,000 people to drug overdoses a year, 100,000. That's Yankee Stadium filled to capacity twice over and then some. Think about that number. And where's the outrage? Where's the screaming? Where's the photo op for the crooked politicians? Did I say crooked politicians? Damn it, I hate to be redundant. Forgive me.
It's kind of like an oxymoron there, isn't it?
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
I mean, trying to find an honest politician, and there are a few, but for the most part, trying to find an honest politician is kind of like trying to find a virgin in a house of ill repute.
Absolutely.
And if I sound enraged, I am. because all that most of these bloody bastards care about is that photo op and campaign contributions, and they're out there already on one side of the aisle or the other. Fund my campaign because of gun control, for it or against it. Send me money.
And that's the heartbreaking thing about it, because these guys so callously are standing on the bodies of these children in order to do this. That's all they're doing.
And they did it on 9/11, and they did it on 9/11, and now they ignore 9/11, and there were over 3,000 people killed that day, and almost an equal number have at least since then died because of their exposure to the toxins released when the towers collapsed.
Right.
But what's the crisis of the day, the crisis du jour? What's on the menu today? We have people gunned down in the streets, and obviously the guns are the problem. Look, I've taken a lot of guns off the street. I was an INS agent for 26 years. I was an immigration inspector for 4 years. But I was out on the street for 26 years, half that time with the drug task force. I've locked up murderers, terrorists, fugitives, child molesters, the cream of the crop. I used to tell people that I was a human garbage collector. And it wasn't just Latin America. So for those of you who want to scream Cutler is a xenophobe, no, I am a bigot. I admit I'm a bigot. I hate violent criminals. I hate con artists. I hate people who hurt other people. Okay? I hate them with a passion. I loved going out and making arrests and getting people off the street because I felt we were making the streets safer. But not today, because you no sooner bring that person to jail when some dopey prosecutor with an agenda is going to release them anyway. It's not a I'll tell you, I talk about the revolving door that exists in Washington between the lobbyists and K Street, or K Street and Capitol Hill, rather. And I've often said that if you want unlimited clean energy, just attach a generator to the revolving door, and those damn things spin so quickly, we'll have so much electricity, we'll have to sell it someplace overseas. But let me tell you what, there's another set of revolving doors that might be spinning even faster, and it's the doors of justice where bad guys get arrested and arrested and arrested and released and arrested and released. And we had a guy gunned down who happened to have been an immigrant from Mexico, shot to death for no good reason. He was on the subway car a couple days ago going to brunch, I believe, with a family member. The American dream, the guy is a finance guy, doing well for himself and his family. Gets on the train to go to brunch. Some guy walks up to him, no good reason, shoots and kills him on the subway car. And we come to find out that the guy had been arrested at least 16 times before. Those spinning doors killed that man. Those spinning doors. And to listen to these sanctimonious Cretan politicians who come out there and say, we got to get the guns. How about getting the criminals? I took a lot of guns off the street. I took them away from some very dangerous people. I've lost friends in law enforcement who were doing their job. But let's defund the cops. Let's go after the guns. But let's turn the criminals and sociopaths loose in the name of equity. What? Are you serious? I'd love to know what the toxicology reports look like for every mass shooter. How's that for an interesting thought? I'd like to know what was surging through their veins when they pulled the triggers repeatedly. No one talks about that. I'd like to talk about young men who are having hormone storms, as we remember from our adolescence, who are now being told that if they exhibit, quote, toxic masculinity, there's something wrong with them. We all have a problem at that age, if you could think back that far. And for me, it's really the horse and buggy era. I'm on the wrong side of 70. But when you're a teenager or when you're approaching 20, your self-identity is murky. You're trying to sort it out. You're worried about the future. You don't know what your place in society might be. And now we're telling those children that if they exhibit what are normal male characteristics, they're suffering from toxic masculinity. What does that do? What does it do when you remove societal reference points? Imagine going to your old neighborhood and they took down the street signs, and most of the buildings that you remembered have been knocked down, and you're trying to find your way to McDonald's. Lots of luck. Because all of the reference points that help to guide you around town are missing. Society is missing reference points, and I believe it is done purposefully. And it's remarkable because language is always the key. remember when a new product came out and they said it was exciting, it was revolutionary, right? Now,
yeah.
What do they say
yeah.
when they come up with something? It's disruptive. When I was a kid, if you were disruptive, your parents got a phone call and it wasn't a happy call. Now we're told that being disruptive is a positive. Demonstrating male masculinity is a negative, and we're told to follow the science. Do you know any animals where the male species doesn't demonstrate masculinity as a clear defining characteristic? Look at Darwin and survival of the fittest. Follow that science. Follow that science. So you're turning the minds of children upside down, inside out. You have a woman that wants to be the next Supreme Court justice saying that she couldn't answer the question about who gives birth. Talk about societal reference points being blown away. And then you wonder why we have a problem. 60 Minutes did a report a couple of weeks ago, and this is even before COVID, that American teenagers are in emotional crisis. We've never had more kids in emotional distress, attempting suicide, talking about suicide, questioning their place in the universe. And the guns are the problem. We've had guns for quite a while. We've never had more mass shootings than we do now. And look at what happens when parents get involved. I was the Parents Association president at my daughter's public school. I was flattered because both the principal and the parents approached me and asked me if I would take the position. And I did, of course. Well, you know what you call a parent who's now concerned about the education that his or her child is receiving? You call them a domestic terrorist.
A terrorist. That's exactly right.
So
an enemy
the biggest problem that kids, the biggest problem kids have is when they come from broken homes. We always know that that's a problem. In an ideal world, every child gets raised by a mama bear and a papa bear, and they're all loving and considerate, and they all help the child to develop a positive self-image and realize that the possibilities are endless if they're willing to work for it. My parents did it for me. Tragically, I lost them both to cancer while I was in college within a year of each other. I speak about them frequently because they're in my thoughts and my heart and my mind every day because I still stand on their shoulders even though I haven't seen them in more than a half century. Parents can make all the difference in the world for good or bad. And when you have children being born into families that don't have stability, that don't have two parents, it's a problem. And then you give them video games that glamorize violence, video games that basically are simulators for mass murder. Think about it. I've done the racing simulator. You see, my son bought me a gift. I have wonderful kids, and he bought me a gift. It was track time in a Ferrari at a racetrack a couple of weeks ago to celebrate my birthday, which was wonderful. We both drove. It was intimidating. I don't mind telling you. I had dreamed of racing as a kid. I knew people who were race drivers. They tried to convince me back when I was in my 20s to quit law enforcement and take up racing. I did a little single-engine flying as a kid. If it goes fast, I'm all in. I have a need for speed. But racing games are fine. Flight simulators are wonderful, unless you're using it to prepare to hijack an airplane, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Mario and all those other games, they're fine. But when you have a game where the object of the game, for example, Grand Theft Auto, what is that message? When you have music that's misogynistic and celebrates violence, what do you expect? So you have children who are latchkey kids. They come home. They're by themselves. And with COVID, a lot of these kids were locked in. And they come home, and they turn on the TV, and they go to the movies, and they watch not only violence but wholesale violence. And all these actors and actresses who are out there screaming, take the guns, take the guns, take the guns. And they themselves are wielding the guns with great abandon, blowing people up, driving cars through houses, cars flying through the air and exploding, bodies going everywhere. And these actors and actresses are making how much money? And then they have the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to scream about violence and guns. Think about the insanity to that. And I had dinner with a Hollywood actor. I won't tell you his name. He's been around for a very long time, very respectful. I was with him twice, and he told me an interesting story about Hollywood. And he said, Mike, I hate Hollywood, even though I've been there for decades. I said, why? He said, do you know how many times they will approach a star and say to him, we want to hire you for this movie. We're going to give you $10 million. And the guy looks at them and says, are you kidding me? 25 or nothing. Well, where's the money come from? You know, that army of cameramen and electricians and carpenters and all those people, that army that shows up when they make the movie, they are told, you want to work on the film? Okay, but you're going to have to take less than scale because Mr. Big Shot won't take less than $25 million and the money's got to come from somewhere. And these are the people we look up to. These are the role models. What am I missing, James?
Well, I'm not really sure that you're missing anything, Mike. I mean, it bothers me that the hypocrisy and the dishonesty is so straight-faced, if you know what I mean. It's not only do they lie to us, it's a casual arrogance in their expectation that we're going to just believe
it,
or at least not question
it. They will look you in the eye as they do it. They look you in the eye without flinching when they do it.
Yeah. And the expectation
is... How about a movie...
I was going to say the expectation
how about movies that
is we either believe it or we don't say anything.
Yep. How about a movie that demonstrates how people work out a problem? We were just watching a movie with Paul Newman, the late, great Paul Newman, who was also an amazing race driver. He said he couldn't do anything that was graceful other than drive a high-powered car. And I'm trying to remember the name of this. I don't think it was Nobody's Fool. It may have been Nobody's Fool. But there's an interesting line in the movie where someone says to him, have you ever been so mad that you wanted to shoot someone? And I thought this was brilliant. And he said, absolutely. And then he hesitated, and he said, and that's why I don't carry a gun. Wow. Think of the carnage. Here's a star in a movie, asked the question, written by the script writers, obviously, the screenwriter. But the question was, have you ever been so mad that you wanted to shoot somebody? And he said, absolutely. And that's why I don't carry a gun. Wouldn't that be a better message for Americans today, for American children today? Yes, I've been mad enough to shoot somebody, and that's why I don't carry a gun. How's that for an interesting thought, James?
It's a bold idea, and it's a very honest idea, so it's probably not going to catch on.
Well, you know, but think about that. But that's what the movie ought to be about.
Yeah, I agree.
Solving problems, showing people overcoming adversity, that's a wonderful theme. You look at Aaron Brockovich looking for justice against some polluting mega corporation. Wonderful storyline, and it was about justice, and justice prevailed. What a novel thought. Justice actually prevailed, and it did in real life, too. Why not celebrate that? There's other cases like that. No, we're going to show people getting involved with drugs, getting involved with prostitution, naked bodies flying through the air, and lots of blood and guts. And then you wonder what's wrong with children. And you have parents who may mean well, but say, I'm my daughter's best friend. And I say, great, how old is your daughter? 13. Well, if you're an adult and want to be a 13-year-old's best friend, get help. You're in trouble. But that child is in even bigger trouble. My kids are all my best friend now, but they're all adults, and they all have careers, and they all graduated from college. They are now my best friends. Believe me, they did not think I was their best friend when they were 12 years old. I promise you.
Well,
but
and you're not
we're
going to
go after the, no, and but we're going to go after the guns. The guns are the problem. Cars crash and people die. No one ever said, let's go after the cars. Right?
Right.
And if you take a gun away from a guy that's determined to kill lots of people, he could always get a can of gasoline, rags, and a match. Right? But we're not going to talk about that because there is an agenda, and the agenda is that the guns are evil. This is a remarkable era in which we live. When someone is now appointed for a position in government, they celebrate the fact that the person is transsexual, transgender, anybody but a white guy who's straight.
Or anything
but
qualified.
Yes, but here's my point. I don't care. You know, I love what Barry Goldwater said. He said, I don't care if you're gay or straight to go into the Army as long as you can shoot straight. I'll agree with that. But show me the qualifications other than these superficial, you know, people said to me, wouldn't it be great if Hillary was president so we'd have a woman president? I said, I'd love to have a woman president, but the person has to be competent, trustworthy, have integrity and appropriate experience. When you go to the hospital, God forbid, you're not well, a family member's not well, there's been an accident, someone, whatever. You don't go in there and say, get me a transgender. You say, no, get me the best doctor you've got. How is it that this identity politics continues? And I have to tell you, if you watch Fox, they scream about identity politics, but then they will turn around in the next segment and talk about the polls and how Latinos are voting and blacks are voting and so forth. Well, they're buying into identity politics, aren't they, by doing that?
Well,
see,
and,
if you
and they're
want
capitalizing
to really,
off of it, too.
Yes, and if you really want to talk about demographics, that's cool. I'm with you. So here's some demographics that I've never seen talked about. The 22-year-old voter who's coming out of college and worried about a career, that's a demographic. It's big, and it's a significant demographic. It doesn't matter if you're black, white, green, or purple, does it? You're 22, no. You're starting out, you have concerns. An old bum like me, I'm retired, I have different concerns. The people who live in cities have different concerns from people who live on farms or rural areas. We worry about mass transit, they worry about the price of soy, right? Think about that.
Right.
Education is an issue. People who have children versus people with no kids. Yeah, that's a demographic because you're going to be more concerned about the educational system if you have children than if you don't. So these are reasonable demographics. Tell me, when was the last time you saw any pollsters on any program, on any network, talk about those demographics, James? Go ahead.
Not ever. Not ever. Everything that I have seen from pollsters, they compartmentalize as much as possible every single splitter faction
by race, by ethnicity, right?
Yeah, they're always talking about it. Always.
So
Latino
let me ask
voters
you a
are upset with Biden or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think that two people who have the same age, the same background, the same income, equivalent educations, but of different race, do you think that they're materially different in their concerns? Probably not. But they make it sound on these programs as though there is a gap between them because one guy's black and one guy's white. One guy is a Latino. No, people have common concerns. This is a divide and conquer strategy. It's a food fight.
Yeah.
Now, when I started doing TV shortly after 9/11, one of the producers took me aside. He goes, Mike, you're really good on TV. You have real presence. But this is a food fight. I said, no, it's not. We just got attacked. We're trying to educate the American people about how to protect us against the next attack. And they wanted a food fight. So how do you have a food fight? Divide and conquer. Black versus Latino, Latino versus white, Asian. And it's working because you have people of one ethnicity or the other looking at those polls and thinking, well, gee whiz, maybe I should feel a certain way because I'm in that group and not this group. This isn't helpful. It's divisive and it's destructive. And it's time that the American people recognized it for what it is and contacted these yo-yos and said, hey, listen, knock it off. We're Americans. When I was riding with a black partner or an Asian partner or a female partner or whatever, do you think it mattered to me as long as I could trust that person sitting in the other seat in that car? I could care less if they had three eyeballs and polka dots. Are they trustworthy? Do they know what they're doing? Can I count on them if it hits the fan? Period. It should be the same. It's the same in the military. It should be the same in society. The whole point to the civil rights movement was to not prejudge people, to say, oh, that guy's black. We have to find him guilty. Well, now they flipped it and said, well, the guy's white. Now he's no, it's wrong no matter how you do it. Justice is supposed to be blind. That's why Lady Justice wears a blindfold. The facts are supposed to drive the decisions, the facts, not the prejudice. And what has happened now is that we have never seen more racism in America than we do now. And I find it remarkable, and I'm a lifelong registered Democrat, and most Democrats probably don't know this, but the Democrat Party was the party of the KKK.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, in the convention back in 1922, I believe it was, they tried to oust the KKK from the Democrat Party, and they failed miserably. So the party that's out there screaming about identity politics and racism and bigotry and cancel culture is the party of the KKK. Isn't that remarkable?
And has been. I mean, they've been a racially motivated party since the end of the Civil War.
Isn't it remarkable? And now you look at what's happening, and you have Joe Biden out there saying, don't you dare talk about how this is a replacement effort when it's actually a replacement effort. Bringing in millions of people from the third world, and what are they going to contribute to society? Their race. That's the only conclusion I can come to. And I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine. I hope everyone will go to frontpagemag.com. I've been writing for them since 2014. It's sponsored by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I'm very proud to be part of that. And my most recent article, let me pull this up, because hang on one moment. Bear with me. Okay. So the title of my article was Title 42 and Chaos on the Border. And the subtitle, Mayorkas, and we all know Mayorkas is the head of DHS. Mayorkas is not America's guardian. He's its innkeeper. And we knew that he was a problem because back when he was the deputy director of Homeland Security under Obama, and before that he was the director of Citizenship and Immigration Services, he ordered the adjudicators. Remember, I did this job. I'm very familiar with all these jobs. He was ordering people to approve petitions for visas that legally never should have been or could have been approved. Even when the FBI came to him and Homeland Security Investigations came to him and said, don't approve those visas because the company has a potential link to an Iranian terrorist group. I mean, think about that. And he said, I don't care. And they approved the petitions for visas, the treaty investor visas, visas used by spies and we believe by terrorists embedding themselves in the country. You put up enough money and you get a visa. Buy your way into America, all for it, the selling of America. This administration needs a new cabinet-level official, the official auctioneer, but so have so many other administrations in the past. If you don't like lobbyists, folks, the only thing worse than a lobbyist is the employee of a lobbyist. Do you know who the employees of the lobbyists are today? The politicians.
Yeah, I was going to say they're
Think
all in Washington, D.C. looking
at
your job.
Relationship. Yep. The employer writes the check. The employee deposits the check. Who's writing the check and who's depositing it? The best government money can buy, as I wrote in another article. So you look at chaos on the border and you say, why would Mayorkas want to, why are we looking at Title 42? So first of all, I'm sure most people by now know what Title 42 is, but in case you missed the point, Title 42 is a section of law that's under the purview of the Center for Disease Control. And if they believe that there is a pandemic, the threat of the spread of disease into the United States, they have the authority to say you're not letting aliens in, period. It only deals with a certain number of aliens who are seeking asylum. And by the way, most of these people seeking asylum, most people don't realize this. I think they have about a 2% approval rate. It used to be, in fact, that if you came from certain countries, we wouldn't even entertain the application for asylum. We'd look at you and say, are you nuts? To qualify for political asylum, and it's a subject dear to my heart, I'm Jewish. My family was decimated in the Holocaust. I was named for my mother's mother who died in Poland because of our religion being Jews. My mom came here. My grandmother couldn't. I was named for her because she died in the war. But asylum means, political asylum means you have a credible fear of harm based on race, religion, ethnicity, political orientation, sexual orientation. That's it. That's it. That you face discrimination or worse, perhaps death, perhaps incarceration, based on race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or political beliefs. So you could say, please, I need political asylum. If I go back there, they're going to kill me. Cool. Once you leave that country, the threat is over, which is why Trump had the remain in Mexico policy. You're saying you're at risk in Guatemala, you're now in Mexico, you're in a new country, the risk is gone, you would think. But of course, that's not what this is about. This is about getting people into the United States. And so we also know from the 9/11 Commission report, and again, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, immigration fraud is a huge deal. James, everyone is so fixated on the Mexican border, and that's a subterfuge. We've been hearing about the Mexican border forever. Immigration enforcement, when I hired on with the INS, was run by the Border Patrol. I went to the Border Patrol Academy in Los Fresnos, Texas. Now, I want you to think about how stupid this is. It's a level of stupidity that I didn't even think American politicians were capable of. Now, don't misunderstand about what I'm about to say. The Border Patrol is an important organization. They do vital, extremely hazardous work. I love the Border Patrol, so I want to be clear about this. But the Border Patrol is only one element of many elements of an organization that has many moving parts. If you believe that once we secure the Mexican border, the immigration system is perfect, you've lost your mind and you're listening to too many thieving politicians. Oh, again, I'm being redundant. Forgive me on that one, folks. I have this problem with language tonight. And lying journalists. Oh, what did I just – I did it again.
What?
Darn it. Wow. You know, I'm going to have to write a script. You heard what Musk had said about Biden the comedian who played as a journalist? Ron Burgundy. I'm having a Ron Burgundy moment. I need a better teleprompter. So I'm losing my mind. Maybe later you'll help me look for it. I have a magnifying glass. So anyway, no big thing. So the point of the matter is that aliens are coming to the United States from all over the world. We're a country of 50 border states. Any state that lies on the northern or southern border is a border state. Any state that has access to America's 95,000 miles of coastline. We hear about the 2,000 miles of Mexican border, and it's like, oh, my God. Well, there's over 4,000 miles of Canadian border. Oh, my God. Well, wait a minute. There's 95,000 miles of coastline. Wow. I didn't know that, right? And then any state that has an international airport is also a border state. None of the 9/11 hijackers ran the Mexican border. They all came, if I remember correctly, through international airports. Do we need to secure the Mexican border? You're damn right we do. In fact, we know from hearings that Hezbollah, Middle Eastern terrorist group controlled by Iran that started in Lebanon, is working on large scale, and I'll read the quote a bit later on, but they're working in large scale movement of people and drugs into the United States throughout Latin America to have staging areas for terrorists that they can use to strike us if, in fact, perhaps we get too aggressive trying to stop them from getting a nuclear bomb. So is the Mexican border dangerous and important? Yes. Is it the only thing? Absolutely not. In fact, I wrote an article a long time ago, and I called it immigration, border security and the immigration colander. You know that device with all the holes in it that you use to drain pasta?
Right.
You don't plug one hole in the bottom of a colander and call it a pot, okay? And that's what they're doing. Once we secure the Mexican border, then what? So we've blocked off one hole in the colander, and we're now going to use it to carry water? Really? How stupid do you think we the people are? And people fall for this stupidity. You know how many people during the early speaking events I did would ask me, you know, about the border wall? How tall should it be? Should we run electricity through it? You know, and I'd say to them, well, how many border states are there? And they look at their fingers and they go, well, there's California, New Mexico. And then I tell them, wait a minute, save the effort, 50. What? Well, now they all know because I keep writing and speaking about the 50 border states. Well, back to it again. Crisis on the border. Where are those aliens winding up, and where are they coming from? They're coming from over 150 countries from around the world, not just from Mexico, not just from El Salvador, not just from Guatemala. They're coming from China and Russia and Iran and Iraq and from everywhere. They're coming from the West Indies. They're coming from Africa. They're coming from everywhere. Okay? And so everyone gets all excited about the border wall. and Trump won the presidency based on a border wall. And I've said it before on your show. I'm going to say it again. And if you missed my saying it before, you're going to think maybe I lost my mind. Maybe I did. Don't ask my wife for her opinion. You might not be. I might not be happy with it. The border wall was never intended to stop the entry of a single solitary person into the United States of America. That was not the purpose for the border wall. So when Pelosi stands there and says it's a wall of hatred, it's a wall of shame, it's a wall of... No. If the border wall was intended to stop people from entering the United States, then the border wall would have blocked off ports of entry. It doesn't. It was never supposed to. I compare the border wall. I have three comparisons. I want you all to think about it and discuss this at your next barbecue. Barbecue season's here, folks. So, first of all, think of the velvet rope at the bank that guides customers to the next available teller. It creates an orderly system so that the next person in line gets to see the teller. That's what the border wall does. The border wall is like the cattle runs at the airport that guide passengers to the next available TSA agent. That's what it does. Would you get on a plane if you saw people sneaking past TSA? I don't think so. We're told if you're not willing to live among millions of foreign nationals who snuck past the vetting process, just like TSA does at the airport, that you're a hater, a bigot, and a xenophobe. Think about it. Final analogy. When you go to the baseball park or you go to the football stadium, and this is hard to imagine, but the fans are not allowed to run across the field. I mean, this is so anti-fan, I don't know where to begin. The managers of these teams have some nerve telling the fans, you can't run across the field. You have to come in through a gate. Really? I have to go in? I'm going to go through a gate to watch a game? Why can't I run across the field? The gate at the baseball park or the football stadium is the equivalent of a port of entry. What do you think of those analogies?
I think they're spot on. You have to have a means. Well, there has to be, just like you said, you know, there has to be an orderly method of entry into the United States. They just can't come over pell-mell. And that's and for specifically the reasons that you just said. We've got to weed out the bad people. We've got to weed out the people who don't have any business.
So now here's my question. Yeah. Any politician who is against the border wall, what do we now know about that politician? He's probably a crook, probably on the take. Because without a border wall, drugs and weapons flow freely into America. Without a border wall, criminals and aliens with diseases flow freely into America. And aliens who would take the jobs that should go to Americans flow freely into America. Now, people say, Mike, why aren't you a conservative? Why aren't you a Republican? And I know you're a conservative. And by the way, in America, it's wonderful when we disagree. We always do better when we disagree and try to put two heads together. That's why they always say two heads are better than one. Because sometimes you need to come at a problem from a different angle, different perspective, and then a whole universe opens up that you may not have been aware of. It was the Republicans who, in their quest for no taxes, no regulations, and cheap labor, wanted open borders. It was Ronald Reagan who gave us the visa waiver program, which is dangerous. It was Ronald Reagan who gave us the diversity visa, and it was George Herbert Walker Bush who signed it into law. Okay? It was Ronald Reagan who gave us the massive amnesty, but then didn't hire agents to enforce the employer sanctions provision of the law. So the law is there, but there's no means to enforce it. I've given you a new Ferrari, but sorry to tell you, it's got an empty tank, okay? It's all a magic act. And the Democrats used to be the ones most stridently opposed to an open border. Cesar Chavez is portrayed as this friend to the illegal migrants. No, he was the friend of American migrants. And when they use the term migrant to describe illegal aliens, it's an outrageous use of language, misuse. There are American migrants. Look up migrant. Migrant is a worker who has no fixed place of living or working. They're basically migratory, and they travel around the country picking crops as they're needed. Cesar Chavez recommended violence against illegal aliens because they were displacing Americans and making it easier for farm workers to be exploited. Now, they redo history and they say, oh, he was in favor of the illegal aliens. No, he wasn't. He said that they are the bane of American migrant workers. You see, it's all lies and misstatements and falsehoods. So the whole point is that we want an immigration system that protects national security, public safety, public health, and the jobs and wages of Americans, period. And that's what the system is supposed to do. So along comes it was initially the Republicans, and we still hear this garbage. Well, those immigrants should not be coming here for welfare as long as they're willing to work. Really? And what does that do to the Americans who had the jobs? Screws them out of the jobs. But that was the plan all along. And then you get some nitwit conservatives who will say, oh, that guy's a bleeding heart liberal. Whoa, stop the music. What do you mean bleeding heart liberal? Bleeding heart compassion is now a negative? Who do you want for a friend, the cold-hearted SOB that'll cut your heart out if you're not looking? Or someone who's got your back and will help you if you're having an emergency at 3 o'clock in the morning? See, my parents taught me that if you have five or six friends in your lifetime, enough friends for fingers on one hand, you've done well. And a friend is someone who, when they call you at 3 in the morning, you're only allowed to ask two questions, where are you and what do I need to bring you? But they ought to be willing to do the same for you, or it's a one-sided relationship. And as my mother told me when I started going out on dates, one-sided relationships aren't relationships. Very sage advice. So think of the language. Think of how Americans are clobbering each other because they're all laboring under false notions. There are many decent people who want to throw the borders open because they have been misled, and their compassion is being used as a weapon against all of us. We have limited, finite resources. It's like being in a lifeboat. Imagine you're in a lifeboat. Your ocean liner sank. There's sharks circling frigid water. The waves are crashing, and the boat is low in the water, and you're already overloaded. And there are people in the water. And you think, oh, my God, those people in the water are going to die. We need to let them on the boat, except there's a problem. If they start climbing into the boat will go down, and no one survives. So what do you do? That's the problem we have today. That's the quandary. It's naive to think that you can put an infinite number of people in a lifeboat. It's naive, equally naive, to think that you can bring an infinite number of foreign nationals to America without destroying the United States, not because of xenophobia, but because of environmental and economic concerns. What do you think of that?
Dead on. Just dead on. As you've said many, many times, and I know you're getting ready to touch on the Title 42 thing, but everyone thinks that this immigration system that we have is broken. And you've said it, you've said it enough, and I've seen it enough, and through the examples you've given in our conversations on and off the air, it's working perfectly for those people who want it to work this way. And that's what a lot of folks simply can't get their head around.
It's a delivery system. It used to be, if you go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, it lists who we're supposed to keep out. There's not a word in there about race, religion, ethnicity. If there was, I couldn't have enforced those laws for 30 seconds. Forget 30 years. It starts out with aliens who have dangerous communicable diseases. Think where we are now with COVID. Okay? And Ellis Island was a quarantine station. Aliens who are severely mentally ill. Well, that makes sense. Sociopaths, sex offenders, and so forth. Aliens who are criminals, terrorists, spies, human rights violators, war criminals, fugitives from justice, aliens who traffic in human beings or traffic in narcotics. All excludable. Aliens have been previously deported, obviously. Aliens who've lied on their applications and committed fraud. And then we get to aliens who might become a public charge. Or if they work, because we know they don't have the wherewithal to subsist without working, would displace American workers and drive down wages or cause Americans to lose their jobs. That's what the laws are about. And when they say we're going to modernize the laws, what they really want to do is remove that little paragraph that says that aliens may not work in the United States if Americans are ready, willing, and able to do the work in the general geographic location where the work needs to be done. That's what they want to eliminate. And what the Biden administration has done through Mayorkas, the betrayer that he is to tell employers to hire Americans. You don't have to hire lawful immigrants. You can ignore the immigration laws that are designed to protect jobs and wages of Americans. We are not going to take a single act against anybody who hires illegal aliens as long as they treat them fairly and don't violate tax laws or other such laws. But we have no concern if you hire a whole bunch of illegal aliens. And Mayorkas also said that he has no concern if people lie on applications for United States citizenship. Now, this is very interesting because one of the lies that have been spoon-fed to the American people, in part because we had corrupt people in politics who started in the patrol perhaps and are misleading people, you got to wonder about their ethics. When they were asked, because most politicians are clueless, they depend on their staffs, is it a big deal when someone runs the border? And they were told, oh, it's like jaywalking. So let me be clear about this. There are two sets of immigration law, and this is really important for you to understand. There is a civil section of immigration law, administrative code. And the way that an illegal alien is dealt with administratively, generally, is that we strip them of any lawful status they may have acquired. Maybe we find out they lied, like the Nazi war criminals. They concealed their war crimes, and then we found out. So we strip them of their status, and then we deport them. So it's stripping the alien of any lawful status they may have inappropriately acquired, or perhaps they've committed felonies since they got lawful status. So again, we strip them of status, and we remove them from the United States. That's the administrative part. And yes, we could also fine them $50 or $100 in jail sentence of 30 days, whatever. Minor stuff. That's administrative. But there's a criminal side to the immigration laws that everyone conveniently forgets. Fox News was reporting that the administration said that the Biden administration would not go after aliens who were deported and returned to the United States. That's not an administrative violation. That's a criminal violation. If you are deported from the United States and you come back, you're looking at 2 years in jail. That's a felony. But if you have a serious criminal history, you know what the penalty then becomes? A maximum of 20 years in the federal penitentiary. 20 years. Hardly a misdemeanor. And that's a section of law that I have a lot of pride in because I worked with Senator Al D'Amato when he was New York senior senator to create that law. A bunch of my buddies backed me up because I had to prove to him that I was right. And then unbeknownst to me at the time, the head of investigations in New York, a gentleman by the name of Walter Connery, who had been a New York City police officer, rose to the rank of deputy in charge of internal affairs, retired, came to the INS, and became the head of internal affairs in Washington, locked horns with our people in Washington. You got to wonder why. He was involved with the Knapp Commission after Serpico. Real straight as an arrow guy, Walter Connery. Became my mentor. And he's a lawyer, okay? And Walter came up with a legislative initiative to make it a 20-year felony for aliens who are criminals who come back and get deported and so that we can prosecute them. So I actually wound up arresting the first such alien in New York, a Dominican dirtbag, who lost his green card because he had multiple arrests and convictions for weapons offenses, drug offenses, and crimes of violence. And he thought I was kidding when I said, you're not going back to the beach to do the horizontal mambo with your favorite babe. You're going to a different hotel with bars. He spoke flawless English, and he told me I was a liar. I was there for sentencing. He got 5 more years in the federal jail. For what? For unlawful reentry after deportation. So when you hear this nonsense, oh, it's a nothing burger. Really? Baloney. And by the way, if you lie on an application to get a visa, to get citizenship, to be able to be lawfully present in the United States, and that lie is committed in conjunction with terrorism, the penalty for that is a maximum of 25 years in jail. Does that sound like a misdemeanor to you, James?
No, that sounds pretty serious.
It's very serious. There are very few crimes in the federal code that call for 25 years in jail or 20 years in jail. This is serious stuff. So when you hear this garbage, oh, it's administrative violation. What are they getting excited about? That's our first and last line of defense. Think of it this way. And, you know, I work with the Speakers Bureau down in Washington. And it's really a privilege and an honor to stand in front of a room filled with Air Force brass. And I've done it a number of times. So we have generals and colonels and senior civilian employees of the U.S. Air Force. A couple of years ago, one of the people in my audience, it blew my mind, had just come back from the space station where he did three spacewalks. And so what I like to tell the members of the armed forces, and no one's ever disagreed, the common shared mission of all of our branches of the armed forces is to keep the enemies of America as far from our shores as possible. However, up close and in person, guess who gets that assignment? It's the Border Patrol and it's ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's how serious it is. What Immigration Enforcement does is a follow-on to the mission of the armed forces of the United States of America. Think about that. When they come in airplanes today, it's not like the movies where they're wearing dark face and they're in their battle gear with their rifle and their parachute. The bad guys are coming on commercial airline flights and strolling through the concourse of our airports around the country. That's how serious this is. And the 9/11 Commission was very much concerned about all this. And they talked about how the aliens who came here were using immigration fraud as an abetting tactic. And now you have Mayorkas saying, if you lie on an application for citizenship, unless you're a war criminal, we will take no action. We will not take away your citizenship and we won't prosecute you. We will shield you and protect you. From what? The law? But if you're an American and you attend school board meetings and you challenge the curriculum, the FBI might open a case file. And they want to have an army of tens of thousands of Internal Revenue agents so that if you make a mistake on your taxes or whatever, they will come for you. Now, of course, that could be used as political police because you selectively discover who's been naughty and who's been nice, just like Santa Claus. This is about the control of the American people and turning immigration into total anarchy, which seems to be the objective. So you've got Title 42. You got Mayorkas. By the way, one other point. You should know that when our guys raided the Bin Laden compound, they found a copy of the 9/11 Commission report and an application for U.S. citizenship. Because we've seen time and time again where terrorists have acquired citizenship before they carried out their attacks. That's what their handlers tell them to do. So they get two passports. If you have two passports, and when you get citizenship, you can change your name. And I've testified about this, and to my knowledge, this has not been addressed. Their new passport, their U.S. passport, only reflects their new names. So they're putting themselves in their own witness protection program. So if you have two different names, you fly to one country on your U.S. passport, you put that away, and you travel around the world on your original passport from your original country. And when you come home, you reverse the process. So to immigration authorities, when you come back to the United States, it looks like maybe you just spent 6 weeks in Germany. Well, maybe you spent 6 hours in Germany and just landed in Germany and went on to the Middle East or Europe or God knows where, Africa, Asia. This is insanity. And so Mayorkas is saying, well, if they cancel Title 42, we're going to let everybody in. Now, why does he want to do that? Go back to that article when I called him America's innkeeper. In fact, you know, in the past, I came to call DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender, starting with George W. Bush, who created DHS in such a way that he violated the Homeland Security Act. Immigration was never supposed to be divided between ICE and Customs and Border Protection. They were not supposed to fold other agencies in with it. He did that, I believe, to make it impossible to secure the borders or enforce the immigration laws. If you wonder why Jeb Bush said that illegal immigration was an act of love, perhaps it's the mindset of the Bushies. I wrote an article about Jeb, and I said that Jeb, poor Jeb, was looking for love in all the wrong places, by the way. So,
Yeah, that's very well put, because and he never found it anywhere.
No, certainly not. But so that became part of the problem. So I came to call the Department of Homeland Surrender. But now under Mayorkas, really what he's really turned DHS into is the Department of Hospitality Services. Think about this. If you read my article, Judicial Watch, Corruption Chronicles ran an amazing story, which predicated my piece. And his piece, or their piece, was also based on a report in the news and on an inspector general report about how mismanaged the company hired by DHS to house the illegal aliens, how incompetent they were, and the fact that they were given a $500 dollar contract without competition. Almost unheard of. If I had a damage to a bumper of a government car, I was supposed to go to at least three body shops, and we would go to the cheapest body shop to get the repair done. Think about astronaut Alan Shepard when he was asked what it felt like to ride on the Mercury rocket. Remember what he said?
Yes, the lowest bidder.
He said
bitter.
He was sitting on a rocket made by the lowest bidder.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, this was the only bidder. And it turned out that $17 million had been given to them for rooms that were never used by illegal aliens. $17 million, not pocket change. And you say, well, why would they do all this? Well, it turns out, according to Judicial Watch, and I want you to read the articles. I'm not going to give it, I'm not going to spoil the story completely. But apparently there was a young man who worked for ICE and was part of the Biden transition team who left the team and went to work for this company, whereupon the company got this $500 million plus no-bid contract. Isn't that an interesting coinky-dink?
It's Take interesting. Probably not much of a coincidence, but it's definitely interesting for sure.
And so if we bring in more people, we're going to need more housing. If we need more housing, there's going to be more contracts. If there's going to be more contracts, there's going to be lots more money to be spread around. That's why Mr. Mayorkas is America's innkeeper. So now we know perhaps why they're eager for CDC, the Center for Disease Control, to take down 42 and say, hey, everything is cool, safe to go back in the water. Whoop, wait a minute, we forgot an article that just came out. Let me get the article up on the screen here. You're going to love this one. I got this article from a buddy of mine who I mentored when he was a new agent, and then he went on to become a supervisor, and now he's retired. You know you're getting old when the people you mentor are retiring, and there I am. So, what can I say? It beats the alternative. As long as I get to see the lawn from the right perspective, I see the blades of grass, not the roots, we're okay. So there's a newspaper called the Brunswick News, and there is now a border patrol. It's a federal law enforcement officer training center, and the training center remains shut. You know why it's shut? Well, here's the headline. FLETC, Federal Law Enforcement Officer Training Center, shut down. Rising cases show that the pandemic is not over.
Oh, my God.
When was this article published?
Well, yeah.
May 23rd, just last week. So a week ago, they shut down FLETC, but they want to remove Title 42. Takes your breath away, doesn't it?
It's stunning. And anybody who sees this as simply fecklessness or inefficiency in government or simply corruption, they're not looking close enough.
So you look at all of this, and now you ask yourself, how are they looking out for the well-being of Americans? Look, I haven't been a fan of too many presidents. I'll be honest with you. I think the best president that I could remember, and I was partial to JFK, and Eisenhower. I mean, Eisenhower's resume was unlike anybody else's that I've ever seen.
Exactly.
So they really were American first presidents, including JFK. When was the last time you had a president who wasn't a globalist? Let's be honest with ourselves here, folks. Right? And so,
yeah. I'm trying to think,
right?
Mike, and I'm thinking, we might get to Johnson and maybe Nixon's first term, but beyond that, they've all to greater or lesser
Nixon
degree,
opened up China, and then he said, "Gee, I hope this wasn't a bad mistake." You think? Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to change. I mean,
oh, it
Donald
will. It's
Trump
get
was
worse
a,
unless we the people end this nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean,
Donald
that's really
Trump
what
was an aberration. Right.
And that's why he was treated the way he was. Now, I'm not one of those guys who think that Donald Trump was always right. You know, I have a couple of friends who you can't say anything about Trump without them wanting to throw knives at you. I've jokingly said that for them, if Donald Trump walked into their house and relieved himself on their dining room table, they would laminate it and call it a centerpiece. I'm not one of those, okay?
Right.
I hate for that ugly thought, but what could I say? But you understand the point that I'm making. But he understood one word, and that one word petrified all of them, and that word was sovereignty. Sovereignty.
Oh, yeah.
And so look at where we are today. Look at where we are today. This is all about taking down the borders. I remember testifying at a hearing in Washington, and there was a guy there who was involved with an organization that was allied with the Chamber of Commerce. I call it the Chamber Horrors. And he came up to me during a recess in the hearing because they had to go vote on some bill. And he said to me, you need to stop this nonsense about border security. I said, what's the problem? That border is our first and last line of defense. He said, yeah, that border is an impediment to my wealth. Think about that. That border is an impediment to my wealth. Really? And how do we protect Americans? Well, he didn't give a damn about Americans. And then you have a woman, for example, who's a Republican running for Congress in Florida, Maria Salazar, who's all in on amnesty. And they tried to make the insane sound logical and reasonable. And you hear this on the news all the time. Well, if these aliens have been here for the last 5 years and they've never been arrested. So here's the problem. Under the law, if you're an illegal alien, you've been here more than 10 years, and you have an immediate family member who's either a U.S. citizen or a lawful immigrant, you can apply to have your deportation ended. Not for you, but for them, for the family member. But we're talking about very few cases, you know, 10 years, resident alien, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. En masse, how do you determine how long an illegal alien is present in the United States? Aliens who run the border don't create a record of entry. There is no capacity to interview millions of people. Let's be clear about this. And there's no magic way. You know, everyone thinks, oh, we'll fingerprint them and the machine will light up and we'll know everything, including what they like for breakfast. It doesn't work that way. Okay? So if you want to know how long someone's been living here, and they ran the border, entered without inspection, EWI in the parlance that we used to use, EWI, entry without inspection, you have to go out with a photograph, knock on doors, and talk to people. Do you know this guy? When did you first see him? How long has he been living here, right? Well, there's no capacity to do it. You're talking about potentially tens of millions of illegal aliens who snuck in. So what are they going to use to determine how long they've been here? Whatever they claim on their application. You mean they might lie? Now, no one talks about this number. I've talked about it on your show before, but we've got to talk about it again. Because Ms. Salazar and many other Republicans want comprehensive immigration reform. A while back, in 2006, they had done some hearings about the topic. They wrote an op-ed for the Washington Times, Senator Sessions. And I was really disappointed in the way Trump mistreated Sessions. I know he recused himself. Trump should have just moved him over to head up Homeland Security, or at least sent him on the way with a handshake, not by attacking him, because he was brilliant in the Senate. I've had dinner with Jeff and his wife. He was one of the best voices for sane immigration policies of anybody who has ever served in the United States Congress, period. Okay? And so... Sessions liked my article so much because what I wrote was, the article was entitled Immigration Bill and No Go. And I compared all those hearings with the countdown for the launch of Space Shuttle Challenger. And I said the reason that they have countdowns in Washington is for the experts to weigh in as to whether or not they should go forward with a launch. The reason they hold hearings in Washington is for the experts to weigh in as to whether they should go forward with legislation. And I think, I said, think what happened when they launched Challenger against the advice of their best experts that cold January morning in 1986, when Challenger, about 72 seconds after liftoff, was obliterated in a horrific explosion. But I said, now it's not the lives of seven valiant astronauts hanging in the balance, but the lives of 100 million, 300 million odd people, Americans. And I said, if we're going to be honest, let's call this piece of legislative garbage what it truly is, the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. And he liked it so much he quoted me from the floor of the Senate. And he said that it was his belief that my words that he was able to quote convinced enough of his colleagues to vote down bad legislation. Well, now I'm referring to this as the Overwhelm America Act. While we keep hearing 11 million illegal aliens are present, it's closer probably to 30 million, maybe more, but that's not even the number. Just like we heard that Reagan's amnesty was going to involve 1 million and we wind up with 3.5 million, that's a lie. More lies. They're all lies. Because no one talks about the fact that every alien who gets legalized has an immediate and absolute right to petition to bring in all their minor children and their spouses. So if, let's say, on average, each alien claims 4 kids, and if they don't check for fraud, it could easily become 10 kids. God only knows. The sky's the limit. But I'm going to be an optimist and say, on average, 4 per alien. What's 4 times 25 million?
100 million. Right.
Can someone tell me how America would deal with an influx of 100 million immigrant children from around the world? They immediately have to be enrolled in school. They need more than a pillow to sleep on because everyone here needs water and food and sewerage and electricity and transportation and access to health care. And if they're children, they need education. They need clothing. They need housing. See, here's my contention, and I wrote an article about this. If you want to have a massive immigration bill, then it must be preceded by an environmental impact study. How's that grab you?
Well, I think it grabs me just fine. You know, the resources of this nation, like the rest of the world, are limited. They are finite in their scope, and we have to conserve them as best we can. And Americans first in the United States. In America, it should be American first.
And that's what, and that was Trump's policy, Americans first. And you know, it's so funny. I wrote a piece, and I was in touch with some of the people that wound up in Trump's administration. If you remember, when Trump was inaugurated, he said that he was taking a pledge of allegiance to the American people. That was the topic of one of my pieces that I wrote. That I'd love to have a politician, especially a president, willing to say a pledge of allegiance to the American people, much the way we say a pledge to our flag and to the republic for which it stands. But I also said that politicians need to hear from Americans, not America first, Americans first.
Yes.
Because
yes.
Today, America seems to imply corporations. We need to bring in the world's best and brightest. Really? Well, what does that do to the average American? Screws them out of a job, destroys wages, and leads to more homelessness and helplessness, doesn't it? So
it wasn't the Sri Lankans that went to the moon.
Yes. So what we need now is a policy that I would call Americans first. Not America, but Americans first. What do you think of that, James?
I think it's spot on. Like, again, the best and the brightest. It wasn't Sri Lanka that went to the moon. It wasn't Ireland. It wasn't Canada. It wasn't Mexico. It was America.
And then,
the
of course,
States.
The other,
that's
and then
right
the
here.
Other side will say, yeah, and they'll say to me, well, you would have kept out Albert Einstein. I said, no, that's not the case at all. We should attract the world's best and brightest. Look, I had a real problem with Wernher von Braun coming to America. That guy was a war criminal.
He was a Nazi, for God's sake.
Yes, and he got the highest military award. It was their equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor bestowed on him by the Third Reich. So, you know, and when I made that point in front of a room full of generals, it was interesting because they looked at me. It was like that moment of thought, and then a couple of them actually flashed me a thumbs up. We brought him here because his guys at Peenemunde in the Harz Mountains in building the V-2 rockets had leapfrogged rocket development by 20 years, and we needed that development. So we brought them here because they served a purpose. But in the beginning, they were kept at that base. They weren't allowed off the base. They weren't trusted. It took a long time. So understand that. But they built the V-1 and V-2 rockets, which were weapons of terror. Those bombs were used to destroy British towns. They bombed London with those rockets. There wasn't military targets. The V-1 was a buzz bomb. It was a ramjet. It looked very much like a cruise missile. It made a buzzing sound,
right,
which is why they called it the buzz bomber. They aimed it in the general direction of England, And when it ran out of fuel, it just arced over and crashed. In some cases, fighter pilots were able to destroy them by shooting them up in the air so they detonated before they hit the ground. And I believe there was a story, I hope I'm not misspeaking, about some incredible pilot who intentionally crashed his plane into a V-1 to prevent it from hitting the ground and blowing up. So, and then the V-2s made no noise because they were supersonic. The kaboom was followed by the boom, okay? You had the blast, and then the sonic boom caught up. But that rocket became the predecessor to the Redstone, which was the rocket used in Project Mercury to launch astronauts Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom on their suborbital flights. So we brought them here because they served a purpose. Certainly Einstein was a wonderful, and I got to talk quickly about Einstein, because when I hear people saying to me now, follow the science. By the way, follow the science. Scientific American, and I just found out that my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law, and our little grandson has COVID. They were just here this weekend. We're concerned. And we've all been vaccinated. We all had all of the appropriate boosters. And lo and behold, and I know so many people, and I'm willing to bet you know people who had all the vaccines, and lo and behold, they come down with COVID, right? Yeah, how is that possible? And we were told that the vaccine had a 90% efficacy rate. And I always challenged it, whether it was during Trump or Biden. How do you know long-term how effective this damn thing is going to be? We've never rushed a vaccine into production this quickly. And I was always troubled by that 90%, 85%. It was so exact, 86.23%, you know, whatever. It was ridiculous. So Scientific American, which is a highly respected and reputable science publication, they've been around forever. I believe they're around about 150 or 175 years. Very well established. I've been reading it since high school. I was originally a science guy. I was going to be an aerospace engineer. Two of my boys are engineers. So Scientific American published an article that was in Nature magazine under the topic of epidemiology. Now, catch this headline, and I'll read to you just the first two sentences. Long COVID risk falls only slightly after vaccination. Wow. What happened to the 90%, boys and girls? And the subtitle, results from a large study suggest that vaccines offer less protection against lingering symptoms than expected. This was published May 27th this year, 3 or 4 days ago. So let me read the first paragraph to you. Vaccination against SARS-CoV-2 lowers the risk of long COVID after infection by only about 15%, according to a study of more than 13 million people. Breathtaking. But if you dare challenge it, you might be a domestic terrorist. In the Second World War, before the Second World War began, Albert Einstein was run out of Germany. Now, everyone knows that story. And I said, well, he's Jewish. It wasn't a good thing to be a Jew in Germany back then. Well, it's worse. He was giving lectures on college campuses, and the Third Reich, the machinery, got two Nobel-winning physicists who were Nazis to criticize Einstein and accuse him of practicing Jewish science, whatever that is. And what did they take issue with? His theories on relativity, which if you've been following current literature, just about every aspect of his general and specific theories of relativity have been proven. Gravitational waves, black holes, you name it. Right on the money, good old Albert Einstein. And his laboratory was between his ears and a chalkboard and a piece of chalk. That was it. And it turned out he got it right. Gravitational waves, everyone thought they were theoretically possible, and now there's a device that uses long-distance lasers, and they've actually seen gravitational waves. Ripples in the space-time continuum. He predicted it. Everyone else thought it was crazy. He knew what he was talking about. But to discredit him, they brought in these two Nazis who wrote these letters and said that he was a danger to the Reich, and they threatened to kill him. It was like Antifa today. The riots broke out, and he said if I don't leave Germany, they're going to kill me. They tried to kill some of his colleagues also who were Jewish. So today, when I'm told, follow the science, and there's no discussion permitted, that scares the hell out of me, because as Voltaire wisely pointed out, that you judge a person's intelligence by the questions that they ask. Today, if you ask a question, it's almost a matter of papal infallibility, and it's seen as an act of heresy, isn't it? We should always be asking questions. So we're told, follow the science and look at Scientific American. Vaccinations against SARS-CoV-2 lowers the risk of long COVID after infection by only about 15%. When will they cancel Scientific America, I wonder, James?
As soon as it becomes a danger to the narrative, as soon as it becomes a danger to the agenda.
I think they're there now. This article has got to have some people very upset. And that's my point. This is about having the courage to stand up and say no more. You know, the movie Network, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah,
why
exactly.
Are we the people being pushed around by a vocal, crazy minority? I don't care what your sexual orientation is. Just don't tell me how I'm supposed to conduct myself. Respect, like a relationship, go back to what my mom taught me. A one-sided relationship isn't a relationship, and respect has to flow both ways. You want me to accept the fact that you think you're a girl, even though you have different equipment? I'm troubled by it. And I'm troubled by this bathroom business and fluidity of orientation, because, you know, I worry about men and women and bathrooms and prisons and all kinds of crazy things. But we can get into that conversation. But think about it. They expect us to say, you have that right, but you, on the other hand, exhibit toxic masculinity, so you need to be canceled. It's time to stand up and say enough. And, you know, if you look at the box office numbers from the new Top Gun movie, they're off the charts. Now, why do you think
Absolutely.
That is?
Absolutely.
Now, I think it's a barometer, and it tells you where the average American is at, and I'll tell you where they're at. They love this country. They love what that flag stands for. And they've probably had it up to their eyeballs with all of this fertilizer being spewed around by people who need to be put in a room with rubber padding. What do you think of that?
I think you're spot on. I think that it's cliche, Michael, when go back to Superman, okay? Truth, justice, and what?
And the American
way.
All
right, and it sounds very cliched and square or hokey or whatever, but you say that to the right people, the people that like this movie, for example, and they understand that that's not a cliche. They understand the substance behind what that means, the ideals behind truth, justice, and the American way. And
well, and you know, and I'm sorry, I didn't need to speak over you. Go ahead, James.
The only thing I was going to say in closing on, as far as that thought goes, they see this. And they understand it, and they look in Washington, D.C. at the people that are standing with American flags in the damn backdrop, and they know that it's not truth. They know that what they're seeing is not just, and they know it's damn sure not the American way. It is an antithesis of all those things that you and I believe in as Americans.
And you know, I have to tell you, I've traveled all over the country. We and I were just talking about it off air earlier. A couple days ago. I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn. I have some real good friends down in North Carolina. One guy's a history professor. And the way I jokingly say it, I could probably say the same about you. He goes hunting. He's taught his girls how to hunt when they were children, basically. And I said, and I've stayed at their home, and I feel like I'm at the home of a family member, right? He's a Southern Baptist. I'm Jewish. He comes from a small town in North Carolina. I come from Brooklyn, part of New York City, the biggest city in America. When he wants meat, he grabs his rifle. When I want meat, I grab my credit card.
Okay? Yeah, right.
Okay, how am I doing? And yes,
you're on it.
We can
you're
sit around, and I have to confess, I had some moonshine. That was a first for me. And it was a wonderful experience sitting around to 2 o'clock in the morning at his beautiful home in North Carolina. Having this wonderful conversation. And he and I have adopted each other. I call him my brother from another mother. He says the same about me. I've been all over this amazing country. And if you sit down for dinner with Americans, and I've done it all over the place, from Seattle to Hawaii to Arizona to Texas to Alabama to you name it, I've been there. What an amazing journey it's been since 9/11. And if you sit down, you realize that we are almost all, I won't say identical, of course we're not, but we share so much more, we agree on so much more than we disagree on. We have allowed ourselves to be divided up by a duplicitous body politic and by journalists who do not deserve the title journalists. This is Orwellian, and I said this a long time ago. This is not political correctness. It's Orwellian. It's thought control through language control. It's about spewing big lies and getting people to believe the lies. You know, I saw an article, and it was an interesting article, that under Biden, Homeland Security was going to stop the raids on immigrant workplaces. Now, this goes back to Jimmy Carter and the use of the word immigrant instead of illegal alien. And I said, you know, if I didn't know anything about immigration, it sounds horrible that we've been raiding workplaces where the immigrants work. My mother was an immigrant. My mom, and I've mentioned it before, but if you don't mind, I'm going to talk briefly about my mom. Because
please.
She, my mom and my dad are my biggest heroes, and I get teary-eyed very frequently. And in fact, when I watch those videos at the train station in Ukraine, it makes me think of my mother, because to her dying day, my mom died of cancer way too young. I was 21 when she passed away. My dad had already died, so I've been on my own since I was 21. But their values, their guidance, my goodness, I stand on their shoulders right now. And she would get up in the middle of the night crying and screaming, and I'd go running into the bedroom. I'd say, Mom, what's wrong? And she would look at me kind of, you know, disoriented, and she'd say, oh, my God, I had such a bad dream. It's as though I was there. And I said, where were you? She said, I was back at the train station saying goodbye to my mother for the last time. She was 13. Think about that. So when I see these images in Ukraine, I think about my mom. And she lived by herself in a rooming house here, came legally, supported herself at 13 by working in a sweatshop making umbrellas for $3 a week. She ultimately became the chief buyer of a dress company during the Depression that was so successful that the owner of that company became one of Roosevelt's dollar-a-year men advising Roosevelt on how to jumpstart the economy. And her boss frequently pointed to my mother as the reason that he was so successful because of how brilliant she was. And all she ever had was a fourth grade education. So when people say to me, you're anti-immigrant, I want to unscrew their head. No, I'm not anti-immigrant. I have nothing against people from anywhere in the world. You don't hold people accountable for those things they have no control over. And that's exactly what racists like Biden do. When you could talk about white, about toxic masculinity and white privilege, where was my mom's white privilege? Where is the white privilege for the people who live in Appalachia and they're starving? White privilege? You know, Ed Koch was probably New York's best mayor. I know that the people who lived in the days of Fiorello or LaGuardia loved him. I loved Koch, although he did maintain the sanctuary policies, but it was a small problem then, and it became a nightmare ultimately. But they asked Ed Koch, who both ran as a Democrat and a Republican, which I loved, and he would walk around New York saying, how am I doing? Right? How am I doing? And he was a very approachable character. And one day he was asked by a reporter to define his political beliefs. And he said, I'm an old-time liberal. And they said, what's an old-time liberal? He said, an old-time liberal believes in leveling the playing field, letting everybody play, and then whoever wins, wins. And what we have done to the minorities in this country, the centers of poverty where the drugs are rampant and no one's doing anything to stop it, bringing in gangs in ways that we've never seen before. I began investigating MS-13 around 1992, and it was a tiny problem. But Obama's open border policy with the unaccompanied minors nonsense enabled MS-13, one of the most violent and pernicious of all the gangs, to metastasize across America. But I've also investigated Asian organized crime groups, Jamaican drug posses. I've locked up members of the Israeli gangs. It's not about race or religion. You judge a person by who they are as a person. When you look at someone and say, oh, he has white skin, so these are the values that we're dealing with, you're a bigot. You're a bigot. And anyone who doesn't get that point needs to have their head rearranged. I met John Lewis. Sheila Jackson Lee, believe it or not, Sheila's a character. I testified for her as her witness twice at hearings. The first time was a very famous hearing, well known. It's actually on the permanent website, the C-SPAN. It was the hearing about how two dead terrorists, Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, got permission to attend flight school 6 months after 9/11. Everyone was aghast. I didn't even know about it. I just came home from a Parents Association meeting with Anthony Weiny, as I called him, and a bunch of other political characters. And we had a big argument about immigration 6 months after 9/11. The stench from that cauldron at Ground Zero still hung in the air. I can't tell you what it was like to be in New York then. And as I'm driving down my block, my phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and there's a guy on the other end of the phone. He says, "This Mr. Cutler?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "America needs you in Washington next week. We have a serious problem." Well, I thought it was a goof. America needs me? It turned out it was Sheila Jackson Lee's counsel. She was the ranking member of the Immigration Subcommittee, and they had just discovered to everyone's horror that Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, they had been in the cockpits of the two planes that slammed into the two towers, had been granted authorization to attend flight school. Could it get worse than that? So, of course, I agreed to go testify for Sheila, and then I convinced her, when they did a hearing about alien smuggling, to not look at the Mexican border but immigration fraud, people coming in with visas. Going back to why, although the Border Patrol is an important element of immigration law enforcement, it's only one of a bunch of elements. If I give you a green card, the border goes away. You can walk through any port of entry and be welcomed home cordially, right? That's why we need to look well beyond that Mexican border, much as we need to secure it. But what was interesting was she introduced me to John Lewis, the civil rights leader who became a member of Congress. And we started talking about civil rights. And I said, civil rights is vital because you can't have a democracy without civil rights. And I know that some conservatives cringe when I use the term democracy. So for the record, there are different forms of democracy. Ours is a republic, but the term democracy means a government that supposedly is governed by the people, governed by the people. From the people comes the power, you see. And so I said, you cannot have a democracy or a republic without civil rights. We have to guarantee everyone's rights to equal justice and equal opportunities. And I said, you know, but my people, the Jewish people, were enslaved long before your people. Think about the Bible and then think about what happened during the Second World War with the slave labor by the Nazis in the concentration camps. I was so angry, by the way. Somebody on Jeopardy the other day said that he had written some material about or a play about how the Japanese people were held in concentration camps in the United States during the Second World War. And I thought that was such an outrageous statement. Look, we did inter them in camps. They weren't free to go. We were concerned about sabotage, and we can debate whether that was just or not. I have problems with it. But they were properly looked after. They had food. They weren't worked. It wasn't slave labor. The concentration camps, these people died of starvation. They were shot if they didn't do as they were told. That didn't happen here. When you trivialize the Holocaust, you're missing the whole point of the exercise. We should be teaching in our schools all about America, good, bad, and ugly. That's important. That way you don't repeat history. But to turn around and hold people today accountable for things that were done wrong centuries or decades ago is nuts. We don't prosecute children for the crimes of their parents. We certainly don't prosecute people for the crimes committed with people of their race when perhaps their ancestors weren't even in the United States at the time. Think about that.
Exactly.
That's what critical race theory is. We should learn about what happened, and I'll tell you why. Because when you realize how much we've risen in that quest to make that more perfect union, it's a message of hope. We overcame stupidity and racism and segregation. We should be celebrating that. And the people who fought against it should be recognized as heroes. I didn't even know anything about the Tuskegee Airmen until it turned out that when I was working at Brooklyn College to try to support me and my mom after my dad died, I worked in the audiovisual center, and I became an assistant to the photographer on campus while I was studying on campus. It turned out that the guy I worked for, a gentleman by the name of George Bing, you can go look up George, was a member of the Tuskegee Airmen. And I was always an airplane buff, and I learned so much from him. And he said to me, Mike, because I had worked for a guy that was from Germany, and he fled when they were about to draft him. This was during the Vietnam era. And he said, you were obviously mistreated by this other guy, and you're in a school, so I'm not just going to tell you what to do, but I'm going to show you how to do things so you come away with an understanding of photography. I learned so much from George about photography, but more important, I learned so much from him about dignity and compassion. And I remember one day during lunch, we were sitting there talking, and I said, how did it feel putting your life on the line to defend the country where you were segregated from the rest of the military? He said, Mike, there's no cure for stupid, but that's not the case any longer. He said, but the point is that no matter how bad you might think America had been because of segregation, it was still, you know, head and shoulders above any other country. And then he looked at me and he said, you lose family members during the Holocaust? I said, yes. And he said, in America, it was the safe haven for your mother, wasn't it? He brought tears to my eyes. He had such dignity and such compassion and such warmth. I've never met anybody quite like George Bing. And the interesting postscript to that story, I remember I was so sorry I didn't act on my inclination to reach out to him. On Martin Luther King's birthday, several years after I graduated from college, I was already an agent, there was a story in the local news about how the high school ran a contest for whoever could write the best story about overcoming bigotry. And this young man wrote a story about how his uncle was, according to his family, the most bigoted guy you could have imagined. He was Italian-American, used to use the N-word. He just was all screwed up. And he said, so here he was in the cockpit of a bomber over Germany, and out of nowhere comes a whole flight of Luftwaffe fighter planes. And he thought, we're dead. It's over. But I don't know if you folks know this, the Tuskegee Airmen never lost an airplane. They never lost the bomber they were protecting, and they certainly didn't lose that bomber either. And so he said that it was unbelievable. These planes came out of nowhere, out of the sun, and they just cut the Nazi bastards to ribbons. He said it wasn't even a contest. It was like a turkey shoot. And he said, so this Mustang pulls up next to him. And by the way, I have a model of the P-51 Mustang. I think it's one of the most beautiful airplanes ever designed. But my airplane has something on it that's better than money can buy, although we did pay for it. I bought it. It's autographed by Chuck Yeager because he became an ace in that P-51 Mustang. So this P-51 Mustang pulls even with the cockpit of this bomber that this kid's uncle was flying during the war. And he goes to snap a salute to the pilot of the Mustang, and to his amazement, what does he see but a black face staring back at him? Could you imagine the scene? So he said that when he landed the airplane, he wrote about it, his uncle ran up to this guy and kissed him. And he wrote back to his family, and he said, if anyone ever again uses that N-word or anything like it, you know, and he went on this whole big tirade about how stupid this was, because if it wasn't for that big, beautiful black pilot, he'd be dead along with the rest of his crew. So I'm telling you the story because the prize that this kid was awarded for writing that wonderful story was a flight, and I believe it was a B-17 accompanied by a member of the Tuskegee Airmen. Guess who went up with him in that airplane? George Bing. Wow. What do you think of that?
That's awesome.
So, and that's an important story. And why didn't they teach us about the Tuskegee Airmen back then? Shame on that system. These men should be celebrated as the essence of bravery and, forgive me, toxic bleeping masculinity. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, those guys, the Red Ball Express, I mean, they're the Navajo Wind Talkers.
Legendary.
Yes. You know, the 442nd Nisei Combat Infantry Group. Our country is replete. We are lousy with people that have come from different ethnic backgrounds and given 110%, 110% of the time, and look at what they achieve.
And we should be teaching it and celebrating
yes.
it. If there's a deficiency, then let's teach this. I agree 1,000%. By the way, one last funny story. I'm looking at the clock. We have a couple of minutes. I took a class in military history. My professor was a gentleman by the name of Bela Karali. He was, as it turned out, the guy that led the Hungarian uprising in 1956. He was spirited out of Hungary. Okay. Then he wound up going back to Hungary, became a member of the parliament. He was a tough character because whenever I would deliver equipment to him at 8 o'clock in the morning, I was always a minute late because the equipment had to come out of the supply room, and I had to run down the hallway. I felt like Jerry Lewis in one of his movies. By the way, I met Jerry twice at the airport, quite a character. And I would bring him the equipment, and one time he actually called my boss, and my boss, Leon Stein, had been a commando during the Second World War. And he complained that I was late by 2 minutes because this guy was a general to his dying day. He stood in front of that room with ramrod posture. He looked as though he sat on a flagpole and it penetrated, okay? And so he was furious that I was late. And one day, he was late. And in front of the class, I said to him, whose office do I call that I had to wait for you? And he invited me to have dinner with him that night. And we did. And I told him who I was, et cetera, et cetera. I took his class in military history at 8 o'clock in the morning. Wasn't a very good student. I was dealing with the loss of both my mother and father by this point. But I wrote a paper about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I wrote about the use of nuclear weapons. And it's interesting because when I got an award from the government of Japan for helping them with a major case over lunch, the consul general told me that the United States saved Japanese and American lives by using those terrible bombs. He said it was a terrible thing, but he said it was Japan that had attacked America. Very interesting perspective. And this guy represents the government of Japan. I wish people would broaden their brains and see things from different perspectives. But the interesting thing about Bela Karali was I found my report. He gave me an A-plus on the report and said, I wish you could have dedicated yourself to my entire class the way you did with this paper. One of the people I quoted in the paper was Edward Teller. Edward Teller, of course, the father of the H-bomb, but hated to be thought of that way, a Jewish guy, by the way. And I'm thinking, whatever happened to Edward Teller, because he was the only one in my paper who was still alive at the time. This was in the 1970s. Here's a coincidence. It gave me goosebumps, and then my goosebumps had goosebumps. 10 hours later, I'm sitting in my booth at Kennedy International Airport. I was an immigration inspector at the time. It was right after Passover, the Jewish holiday. Guess who walks into my booth at Kennedy Airport?
You're kidding me.
Nope, I kid you not. I freaked out. It was Edward Teller.
Unreal. Wow.
And how's that for goosebumps? I shook hands with him, and I said, I understand you have a very unusual progeny. He said, I normally don't like that reference, but I do, considering that you know who I am and what I've accomplished. And I looked at him. I said, you wrote history, and you helped to save America. How in the world could I not know who you are, Professor? And we shook hands, and he thanked me for admitting him, and he said that he was so impressed by the fact that I recognized him and knew what he had accomplished. And that's the point. America is a multifaceted tapestry with everyone from everywhere, and we all have a thread that we contribute to that flag, to that tapestry that is America. And I am so sick of this nonsense, of this divisiveness. We are all our keepers. We should be helping each and every American. We should all be coming together to help each other and boost each other up. And what the politicians are doing is driving wedges between us, and the pollsters are doing it, and everyone's making a profit over the suffering of Americans today, and it's got to be brought to a screeching halt, and we the people can do it. The politicians need to learn that we're not the blithering fools that they thought we were, and we should be reaching out to these news organizations and telling them that you clean up your act or we will go out of our way to not purchase any product that you hawk on your miserable programs. What do you think of that?
I think it's awesome. I think there are people who have different ideas on boycotts, but you know what? They work. They absolutely work.
Well, I don't like them, but what else do you do? Our back is to the wall. Our backs are to the wall, boys and girls. And desperate times call for desperate measures. And I think a boycott is very much appropriate. And they need to understand that we're not going to put up with their Orwellian garbage. You know, when you could write an article that they're going to stop the raids on immigrant workplaces. No, they're going to stop investigating people who hire illegal aliens so the immigrants can't get the jobs and the Americans can't get the jobs. That's what this is about. But that misuse of language has so confounded any honest conversation. That's what's so damn dangerous about this Orwellian newspeak. And we need to stand up to it. And these aren't migrants coming across the damn border. They're aliens. And if you go to the Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 101 definitions, an alien is simply defined as any person not a citizen or national of the United States. And if you could show me where that's an insult, where this is a pejorative term, where this is the equivalent of the N-word, I'll buy you a steak dinner. What do you think of that?
I think you're spot on. I think that, you know, boycotting someone or an industry or business because they made a joke or they support comedians who make jokes about transgenderism is one thing.
I'm definitely opposed to that. That's nonsense. That's what the First Amendment is about.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree with you 1,000%.
But to take this type of, and you're right, a boycott should be a very serious thing, and I think that's what's going on here. And we see it in another way that I was thinking about when you were talking about it, and I'm trying to coalesce my thought here. You and I, and I'm just speaking because we're pretty good examples, and our radio programs, because Michael also has a radio program, Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio. Is that still on Fridays?
Friday at 7 p.m., yes. And if you go there, you can always listen to the podcast, yes.
So that's more and more people are turning off CNN. More and more people are turning off these huge newspapers. They're turning off Fox, and with good reason, and they're turning to this alternative media that's out here in the Internet. And they're trying to get – they're trying – I don't know how much longer we're going to last. To be truthful with you, I don't know how much longer programs like yours and mine will be out there because it's sooner or later they're going to try to – they're going to attempt to shut this tap off as well. This is what's going to kill CNN. This is what's going to kill Fox News.
Well, look, I'm tired of it because you have these people – you have these people sitting in front of the cameras. They're not experts. You know,
no,
political consultant. Really? What is a political consultant? What is a political strategist? What is your prerequisite? You know, when I don't talk about topics that I really don't have expertise in. I mentioned the COVID vaccine. Well, I'm reading an article from Scientific American, and I consider them to be a source. And I will give you the source if I do something like that. I challenge the idea of climate change because you have to ask yourself how much is man-made, how much is it? So I'm willing to ask the questions to get people thinking. But on immigration, my attitude is if you're going to go out there and really stake out a position, then you should have the bona fides to qualify as an expert witness at a trial or at a congressional hearing, or you shouldn't be dabbling in those areas that have such a profound impact on all of us. It's one thing to have an open discussion, to kind of shoot the breeze. Well, what do you think? Does this make sense? Fine. But how about bringing in a person who really has the credentials so the layman could throw those ideas around and bring in experts from both sides or three sides? You know, people say to me, well, follow the science. Think about this. When you go into court, and I've been an expert witness, I actually even, maybe next time I'll talk about it, worked for a defense team because I believe that there was a miscarriage of justice when a farm in Hawaii was accused of knowingly hiring illegal aliens. There was no evidence of that. These guys all had fake documents. And the way the law is written, the employer is liable if they act too aggressively to try to keep from hiring illegal aliens. I kid you not. Just to give you a quick example, supposing you were going to hire me to be the editor of a magazine, and let's say for the sake of argument that I'm a citizen of Canada, and you say, Mr. Cutler, I'm going to interview you, and you interview me, and you say, wow, you've got great qualifications, we're going to hire you, but you're from Canada. I'd like to see your green card. And I say, well, you know, I couldn't find it this morning, but here's my Social Security card. Here's my driver's license. And you look at this and you say, well, wait a minute. And they say, well, if you look at the back of the I-9, that's the form that the employer fills out with the alien. All I have to do is show you one document that proves my authority to work in the country, Social Security card, and another document that proves who I am, my driver's license with the photograph. Now, sometimes you have one document that provides both. A U.S. passport, for example, provides both. There's a couple of documents, but U.S. passports is the best example. A green card provides both evidence as to my identity and the evidence that I'm entitled to work in the United States. But I don't have to show that to you. So my question is, and I ask people this question all the time. So supposing you said to me, well, I see that I'm allowed to accept the Social Security card and the driver's license, but you know what? You're on the clock. I've started paying you as of 8 a.m. this morning. That's when you came in for the interview. But within the next week or two, Mr. Cutler, I would just feel better if you could stop by and show me your green card if you're able to find it, just so that I feel confident that I'm not hiring someone I shouldn't be hiring. What do you think about that approach, James?
Nothing unfair about it.
You just violated my civil rights. You could be prosecuted, and I can personally sue you. You are not allowed to ask for more than the minimum documentary requirement. Breathtaking,
and,
isn't it?
And the thing now, back when you said this with Mayorkas, that guy. Anyway, they will now accept a warrant for the individual's arrest
to get on an airplane.
Identification.
To get on an airplane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so understand the problem. So I agreed to work as an expert witness. And the reason I tell you this is that you need to know that very often at trials, you will have competing expert witnesses who have equal credentials but have opposite viewpoints. So when people say follow the science, what science? Science is the imperfect, ongoing, continuing effort to derive the truth. Einstein, brilliant as he was, arguably one of the most brilliant minds ever put in the cranium of a human being, said that as much as he understood, he felt as though he was nothing more than a child playing at water's edge, looking at an occasional shell or pebble when the vast ocean of knowledge lay before him yet undiscovered. Okay, so when people say to you, this is the science, baloney. This is what we know to this point, but this keeps changing. Just a few years ago, there was no way to take a photograph of a black hole. I don't know if you saw it, but now there have been two black holes imaged, including the one in the center of the Milky Way galaxy using radio telescopes, using what they call the Event Horizon Telescope. It's a series of telescopes that span the Earth so that you have a broad base acting as the receiver for the radio signals. They thought it wasn't possible. They thought there was a sound barrier. Well, Jaeger went through it just fine. So what we think we know today, we may find out next week, is wrong. For the longest time, we were told eggs are dangerous. Now we're told that the protein from eggs is wonderful. We don't know. And when people say this is the only way and you do it my way or else, what you're dealing with isn't science, but totalitarianism, and we need to recognize it for what it is, and we need to call it out. That's the point. Look at how they're having a cow over Elon Musk, and they said, my God, freedom of speech, he's an absolutist. Absolute, yes, the only restrictions on freedom of speech is you can't cry fire in a crowded theater, and if you slander someone, you will face consequences. But other than that, and you know what? If I detest what you say, I'm happy you're saying it. You know why? Because you're letting the whole world know that you're a blithering idiot. By the way, when I met John Lewis, I have one funny thing to say about it, because I know we're at the end of the show. And we were talking about civil rights and how it's not just blacks or whites, that throughout history, one group or another has suffered mightily because of the stupidity of prejudice. And I turned to John Lewis and I said, you know, Congressman, the KKK certainly hates you because you're black, but they hate me and fear me more than they fear you because I'm a white man, but I'm a Jew. So to the KKK, they probably see me as an undercover black man. How's that? Do you know? The late John Lewis and Sheila Jackson Lee, we were in this hearing room and they were in recess. They doubled over laughing. He could not stop laughing. How's that for a fun one-liner? True story.
That's good.
With all the somber news out there, I wanted to end on a little bit of humor. And I have a suggestion, folks. When you have discussions with your neighbors, and I hope you will, please try to end with a question, not a statement. If you end with a statement, people are going to say, oh, there he goes again. But if you ask somebody, if you wouldn't get on an airplane, if you saw people sneaking past TSA, why is it proper then for us to have to live among millions of people who snuck past the similar vetting process we conducted ports of entry? That's one of many sorts of questions you could ask. But the beauty of a question is they have a life of its own. Once you ask that question, it will set up shop in that person's brain. And at the oddest moments, they're walking the dog, taking a shower, washing the car, that question is going to pop up and it will cause them to think. And the best tool in our arsenal is the ability to get our fellow Americans to think and to ask questions. What do you think of that?
Yeah. We have this bumper sticker mentality. I think, you know, our thought process, it's sound bites and it's catchphrases or buzzwords, whatever you want to call it. And a dialogue, it's almost non-existent. And I think
and
a lot of times
they want.
People
they don't want us talking, because if we start to talk and if we get our brains working in harmony, we the people become unstoppable. We need to focus on what makes us most similar, not on what may make us different.
And again, like, you know, to listen rather than as opposed to listening to what someone, especially if they have an opposing viewpoint. Rather than listening to gauge what your response is going to be, you know, and solely listening for that, rather than to try to counter their point, genuinely listen to see what their perspective is, to see what their point of view is, instead of just...
And try to find common ground. Common ground. We all want to get to the same destination. We just may want to take different highways to get there.
What's going on for you in terms of appearances here in the next few days or the next week or so? Are you scheduled to be anywhere on the news?
No, believe it or not, it's a quiet time. You know, everything, again, this is the news. It's driven by if it bleeds, it leads. It's all about the mass shooting, which is sad because, and by the way, isn't it awful that they're out there spewing facts without knowing what the facts are? It makes sense to hold the initial news conference. There's been a mass murder, yada, yada, yada. This is what happened, and we will get back to you when we have done our work and we know what's happening.
Yeah.
The FAA announces a plane crash. They don't have a news conference every 2 days. You know, no, do your homework. Figure it out. Interview all the people. Find out what went wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we've got to be careful. We've got to pay attention. We've got to follow the information where it leads us. And one last thing, when you look at the politicians, ignore the R or the D after their names. Follow who they are by their own specific agenda and ask them one simple question. How are your policies in the best interests of Americans? Simple question. Why should Americans be happy at what you're doing? I'd love Biden to explain how what he's doing is in the best interests of the average American family. That's the question I'd like to see some supposed journalist ask them at the White House. How's that for an interesting question?
A very interesting question, my man. And once again, we've brought it right down to the wire. We got 30 seconds left. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with our friend, our very good friend, Mr. Michael Cutler. You can find him on Friday, 7 p.m. Blog Talk Radio, the Michael Cutler Hour. Be part of his Bucket Brigade. Pass it all around. Michael, can't thank you enough, as always.
Yeah, the Bucket Brigade of Truth. That's right. Bucket Brigade of Truth.
As always.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure, James.
Absolute bliss having you on the radio and getting to talk with you anytime anyway. God bless you. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Be well.
Oh, that's it. That was great, Michael. That was fantastic.
Good. I think we covered a lot of territory.
Well, we always do. And, you know, and that's the magic of having a two-hour program. We can run in any direction we want to as far as we can get.
Wasn't that an interesting story, though, about my old mentor, George Beng? True story.
That's absolutely it is. And like I said, all the, you know, you had the Red Tails. You had the, like I said, the 442nd Nisei Combat Infantry.
But why
don't
we need to teach? But see, this we should be teaching.
Yeah, we should. And you and I know it. But
I was
that's
furious.
Because we found it out on our own.
That I knew nothing about him. I said, why in the world didn't we know about him? Right? We knew about the who was it? The Green Valley? Oh, my goodness. The first example of guerrilla warfare on our side.
The Green Valley Boys.
Yes.
I know who you're talking about from Vermont. Yeah.
So we knew about them, but why nothing about the blacks? Or I mean, think about – that would be wonderful to say, look, we all came together from all over the world with one thing that united us, and it's the American flag. And look at what we accomplished by being united. That should be the emphasis, not – resent this guy because he's white and he had an unfair advantage. You know, when I look at my mom, and believe me, I've put up with a lot of bullshit because people are stupid, and I've heard an awful lot of anti-Semitic shit in my day, to be honest with you.
I'm sure it infuriates me.
But you take it from whom it comes, as George Beng said, you know, they're stupid. They don't know better. He said they're ignorant. I write it off to ignorance. He said it's not worth wasting your time on them. What an amazing guy to take that attitude. And I learned so much from him about being a man, about photography, about race relations. I mean, it was a gift. I worked for him for over a year. When I worked for the German guy, he was truly a Nazi. We were taking photographs from the art books and making slides and then using them in the art classes in a projector, and I would project those pictures also. And so in those days, there was no LED lights. You had flood lamps. And they put a Zeiss Icon camera on like a drill press so you could raise it up and lower it down with floodlights on either side of the base. And you would put the art book on the base, and you would move the camera up and down to get it into focus so you could take the slide. The heat from those lamps was unbearable. It was during the summer in a small room. The temperature had to hit 110 degrees in that room. And so I had a crew cut that summer, and every 15 minutes I'd run out into the hallway, stick my head under the water fountain to cool off, and run back in. And good old, you know, his name was Dieter Geier. Dieter sees me, he goes, "Where are you going?" And he was a young guy. He was like, I don't know, 30-ish. And I said, "It's hot there." "I don't care if it's hot. Get back." And everybody was furious at him. And then one day he came to work, and everyone was standing by the door when he walked in, and they all clicked their heels. And he went batshit. And then one day he doesn't show up for work, and he calls us from Canada, I believe it was, that he fled because he was told that since you're living in the United States, you're subject to the draft, and he ran. And in comes George Beng. This is a true story, and in comes George Beng. And I don't remember my mom might still have been alive at this point. I think so. My dad was certainly dead by now. And it was such a delight to work for him. And he said, "You're not working for me. We're working together. And just think of me as yet another one of your instructors." And he was such a gentleman. And we had lunch together. And we talked about flying. And oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry that when I saw him on that news report that I didn't reach out to him. But my point is that I learned so much from him and from others. And that's the beauty of sitting down with people and trying to treat everyone equally. I love that there's more than just white people doing commercials on TV. That never looked right to me, to be honest with you. right? It's good that we have diversity in the commercials, okay? Although I hated the commercials where the guy always looks like a buffoon, right? Some white guy would always be acting like an idiot. That's wrong. But look, you go into a restaurant, there might be a black guy, there might be an Asian guy, it could be a man, it could be a woman, that's fine. It should be reflective of who America is. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is when you pass over qualified people because you're trying to meet a quota. That's my problem. And I believe that you can bring everyone up to standard by offering them whatever assistance they need. I believe in free college for American children if they're studying a course of study that will qualify them to do a job that's needed. If we need biologists and you have someone who really loves biology and they're living in poverty, why not give them a bachelor's degree for free as long as they work their asses off? My son had a full scholarship to City College. He's an engineer. And look where he is now, right? So and when you hear the super wealthy and they're oozing sarcasm, free college, yeah, you want to build up your citizens. You're so busy just looking at the bottom line, you don't give a shit about the people of this country or the future of this country. If you can elevate children out of poverty, you're helping them, but you're helping America. This is a resource. There's no reason that these kids shouldn't be encouraged and aided in whatever way necessary so that they can take those jobs. If you keep people down, it leads to suffering, it leads to poverty, it depresses the economy because these people are going to need financial assistance, which is expensive. If you can help people to be truly successful and make a great living, then they can pay taxes, they become consumers, they're going to buy the products. That's why we did so well in the 50s, because the middle class was never stronger or more vibrant than in the 50s. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. Look at the cars. Look at the furniture.
The average family has two cars in the driveway that they bought for cash. Try that today.
Can't be done. Not by a middle class guy.
No, and then I'm watching this program selling jets. And these people are oozing, you know, whatever. Oh, well, this is only $5 million. What can we get for $10 million? And we're not talking about a corporate jet. This is a personally owned jet. And the woman looks at the thing and goes, oh, there's no baggage compartment. When I fly, I have lots of suitcases. Well, maybe you'd like to see this Gulfstream 5. Oh, honey, look at how much luggage. And the guy smiles at the camera. My wife has such a wardrobe. And I'm watching this, and I have to tell you, now I'm a capitalist, and if you're worth millions and millions of dollars, and you want to buy jets, or you want to buy, you know, 15 sports cars, it's your money. But my gosh, why is it that no one, or not, I won't say no one, that not enough people look at a situation like that? Because I know, as I've told Susan, if I wrote a book, and then it became a movie, and I was worth millions, I'd have a sports car. I would give in. I'm a Corvette, maybe a Porsche, maybe whatever. I'm not going to have a garage with 20 cars in it, because at that point you then say, well, how can I help people? What can I do? I forgot who it was, an actor or musician, somebody happened to walk into a jewelry store, and this couple was obviously getting married, and the girl's looking at a ring, and she said, boy, that's gorgeous. And apparently it wasn't even that big a deal, but to this young couple, it was a very big deal. And the guy just walked over. He says, do you like that ring? And the girl said, are you kidding me? He said, great. Wrap it up to go. And he paid for it. The guy's, you know, worth a ton of money. I mean, to be able to do that, to put a smile on someone's face just because, the idea of a random act of kindness, that to me is a high. What do you think of that, James?
I would imagine
am I crazy?
That was one of the things.
Am I crazy?
No, I would imagine that was one of the things that made Elvis feel so good at times.
Yeah, he used to buy people cars.
Yeah, you know.
Yep. But why not? How much money do you need? You look at a Bezos. How much fucking money do you need? You look at a Mike Bloomberg. How much money do you need? Mike Bloomberg couldn't bring himself to say that China is a communist fucking dictatorship because he was afraid it would hurt his working relationship. The guy's worth 60 fucking billion. He can't spend the interest on the money that's pouring in through his doors and windows every day. This is sickness. This is sickness. You know, when I stepped forward, I knew it was probably going to end my career, but America was attacked. And I was raised by my parents, and I know they would have agreed with me completely. I don't know if I ever told you the story. We had riots on our campus at Brooklyn College, and I basically lived on campus. You know, I worked. I was a student there, and it was a mess. This wasn't long after Kent State, and you had these kids striking. What were they striking for? 21 non-negotiable demands. And just like today, I'm looking at the demands, and some of them were sort of reasonable, I guess. And then there was a couple of demands that were nuts, and one of them stuck in my head, that the campus police should not be able to challenge people as to their right to be on campus. Kind of like immigration today, huh? And we had infiltrators coming onto the campus. Just a day earlier, some guy approaches me as I'm walking onto the campus, and he said, I have a leaflet for you. I said, thank you, no thank you. And he said, you got to read it. I said, I don't have to read anything. And he made the mistake of grabbing me by my shoulder and shoving his leaflet into my pocket. Until you touch me, everything is cool. Once you put your hands on me, everything is not cool. So I decked him. And there was a cop car right there. He went limping over to the cops. And he said, that man just hit me. And the cop said, we saw you fall down, not once, but twice. How dare you accuse him of hitting you? So I went onto the campus when they had this riot, right? Everyone's on strike and they're passing the bullhorn back and forth. I grabbed the bullhorn and I asked everybody there. They tried to get it away from me. I had a fist fight to hold on to the bullhorn. And I said, do you folks really think it's smart to prevent the campus from police from making certain that outside infiltrators don't come onto this campus and create problems for us? People will get hurt or killed. Do you know most of the people that were there had no idea that that was one of the demands? Within 3 days, the demands were whittled down, and three of the demands, including that one, were off the list. And then I started getting death threats from W.E.B. Du Bois and SDS, the communists. So for about a month, I had the football team escorting me to class, and they posted at least one or two players outside the classroom for about a month. And my mother said to me, I'm scared to death that you could get hurt, but if your father was alive, he would be proud of you. But she said, after what happened in the Holocaust, it's important to stand up when something goes wrong. You see? Wasn't I right for doing that?
Yeah.
I mean, you got to stand up. People said to me, you're going to go to D'Amato, you're going to do this, they're going to get you. I said, who the fuck is they? My father taught me that the only person who could intimidate me is the person that I permit to intimidate me. And I won't allow it. That's the lesson Americans have to start to learn. That's why they don't want men with toxic masculinity, because God forbid they'll stand up for themselves. This is the wussification of America. Am I wrong?
And they've been working to this end for the last 25 years, easy.
And when they said, we're going to fight your battles, I said, well, what if they don't? Supposing they throw a party and your protectors don't show up. My parents taught me, if you want something done right, do it yourself. You know? And that's exactly what's happened. The bullies are now our protectors. Sure thing. How's that working out?
Sure. Oh, Mike.
I gotta tell you, it's always fun doing your show.
Yes, it is, and like I said, I think one of the reasons for that is because we got, you know, ain't no 12-minute limit here.
No, but we do fill the time, and I don't think we ever run out of material or where it gets to be boring or anything.
No, it has never been anything but informative, and most of the time, pretty damn compelling. So, yeah, and again, like I said, when I have guys like you, or Trevor, or David Horowitz,
yep,
David, all the time in the world, because I know you guys can't get that anywhere else. You just can't. I mean, it's the reality of the situation, and I've got this unique opportunity that I can give to these guys, to give to you, to where you know, it's like a gym. It's like you can come in here and work out for a couple of hours, get yourself together, and then the next time you've got to go somewhere, you already have a large measure of those thoughts coalesced and ready to go.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about where do I want to go with it tonight, and it just was like a stream of – I don't have notes or anything. I do have the articles in front of me so that I can reference them.
Sure.
But other than that, you know, it's the magical mystery tour, you know.
I'm the customato of talk radio.
You got to send me the link as soon as it's available.
Okay, as soon as it's down, or it should go into archive here in a couple of hours. So first thing in the morning, I'll get it to you.
That'd be wonderful. Some people wanted to see if they could get a copy of that. So I'm happy to do that.
Sure thing. As soon as it comes up, I'll send it your way in a text.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. All right, why don't you get going? I know you're a busy guy. Everything is good, though, right?
Everything is great. Everything is going great. And here probably over the weekend, I'll get up with you and bring you up to speed on a couple of things we didn't get to talk about last Saturday. But, yeah,
okay, good.
Fine.
Yeah, I would love that.
Okay, you take
will that
care.
Work?
And God, let's
all right,
let's,
kiddo, be well.
Duck that COVID, baby.
Yes, indeed.
Duck that COVID, all right? Take care now.
I'm doing the dope-a-rope.
All right.
the rope-a-dope. I'm trying to remember what he called
rope-a-dope.
It.
Rope-a-dope. There we go.
By the
rope-a-dope.
Way, you know, I shook hands with Ali when he came through the airport. I met him twice. What a gentleman, by the way.
Class.
Oh, my goodness, yes. A towering figure.
All right, I'll be talking to you in a couple of days, man. Bye-bye.
Sounds like a plan. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, my God.